We have no round table, and in fact, we almost have no table, and the panel as it is dispersed here. So what it will be actually is a series of, they've actually clustered.
Segregated.
They've segregated, that's good. Except that John is segregated over there. And so basically we'll have a series of shorter contributions. It won't really be much of a round table discussion. There's the panel members listed over there. These are real-time four-body simulations that John Frigeau has set up. It's an interesting, and unfortunately it switches back to the original screen in between, but that's okay. Let me just preface the comments that these folks will make the following way. It's been known for more than a quarter of a century now that globular clusters are extremely efficient, much more efficient than binaries in the plane at large in terms of producing exotic systems such as LMXBs, CVs, millisecond pulsars, and so on. And it started really in the early 70s with the discovery of LMXBs in globular clusters. We have one of the principal people sitting on the front row here. And later, as we heard this morning, in the 80s, with the discovery of lots of millisecond pulsars, recycled pulsars, whatever you will call them, in clusters. And then, as we heard even more recently, CVs have started, or CV-like systems have started to come out of the woodwork in great numbers. And I think we're now to the point where those are probably being produced with greater efficiency than in the plane per unit mass. Now, this was quick. It was quickly inferred very early on that there must be dynamical interactions, direct interactions among ordinary stars, compact remnants, binaries, and whatnot, in order to produce these systems with such great efficiency. Quick inference turned to speculations about various scenarios, and I would like to say that we've come a long way since scenarios, but in some ways we're still in the scenario phase. These came very quickly in the form of the two-body tidal capture formation scenario, exchange scenarios, and so on, and the scenarios have been building. Fortunately, in the last decade especially, serious tools for looking at this question quantitatively have come into development, principally the self-consistent, realistic number simulations of entire clusters and their evolution, the hydrodynamics for direct encounters among stars, and very importantly and often overlooked, binary stellar evolution tools needed to really understand and go beyond the scenario phase and really understand how some of these end products could come about. And we saw in the very nice presentation by Jared Hurley how, in at least an illustrative way, one could put this all together and see nice things come out. But I would guess that that type of simulation is still in the illustrative phase rather than the definitive phase, and I think he would probably agree. In any case, with that brief introduction, let me start with some short contributions by Melvin and Philip, and then we'll have some questions because those two little contributions tie together, and then we'll see some work in progress towards some serious simulations by John and Natasha, and then we'll have some questions after those two, if that's okay.
Yes, I do.
He's the boss. Great, thank you. I apologize if my voice is a bit ropey. My hearing is actually worse than my voice, so bear that in mind too. Okay, Eric told us some interesting things about neutron star retention, which I think we should discuss more later. But I'm gonna make things a bit simple for me here. I'm gonna think about a neutron star in a globular cluster. And I'm going to think, well, we all think about it, right? Okay, we're going to think about a single neutron star, okay? So we're just going to say that our neutron stars are in the globular clusters, but they're single at some point at least. Now, if I want to take my neutron star or your neutron star and make it a millisecond pulsar, we've got to put it in a binary, okay? So the question is, what are the options? How can we put my neutron star into a binary? There's two basic ways that might work, potentially. Here's my neutron star. My neutron star encounters a single star close enough. Okay, it might raise tides in the single star. It might form a bound system. If you get close enough, it'll definitely form a bound object. Whether it forms a binary or a single messy thing is open to debate, but it'll form a bound system. Alternatively, I can think about a binary, primordial binary, some kind of binary, not containing one neutron star. And a neutron star can come along and exchange in and yank out one of the other components. So the first thing I want to show to get people thinking about this is just to consider the time scale for the neutron star, or any single star, to come within some distance of another object, either a binary or a single star. So just quickly go through encounter time scales. So the first important point, so I've got a blue object and a red object. So one of these could be a binary, it doesn't matter. And the first important point to make, so everyone's aware of this, is the impact parameter. I've got a big spear somewhere. You got the pointer somewhere? Ah, it's hidden. Thank you. Now I feel empowered. So, okay, great. So the first point to make, that's quite an important point for everyone to remember, is that the impact parameter here, so that's the distance, the perpendicular distance at infinity, is quite a lot bigger than the minimum distance here that they pass, the two objects pass within, providing my V infinity is low enough. Okay, if the two stars have a huge V infinity in an encounter, they go zooming by, they don't perturb each other at all, they come rolling in with a relatively low V infinity, they feel each other's gravity, and the arm in is enormously smaller than the impact parameter. Now in a globular cluster, we're in that regime, because the V infinity in a globular cluster is perhaps 10 kilometers a second or so, and when the stars zoom by here, a few stellar radii away from each other, they're traveling up hundreds of kilometers a second. Okay? Now it turns out you can actually work out this boosting factor. We're not going to do that now. And the answer is that the cross-section to pass within a minimum distance r min is not just pi r min squared, that's times 1, but you've got this gravitational focusing term here where the v squared is 2gmt over r min. It's basically the relative speed at r min if they came in with a v infinity of 0 divided by v infinity squared. And I've just told you this v is of order hundreds of kilometers squared, and this is 10 squared here. So this is a really significant term. So that's important for two reasons. The cross-section to get close to something is larger because it's gravitational focusing. More subtly, if this dominates, v squared goes like 1 over r min. And so it's 1 over r min times r min squared. The cross-section to come within a distance r min scales as r min, not r min squared, right? If I take a dartboard and make the radius twice the size, okay, the area of the dartboard is 2 squared, 4 times bigger. So I'm throwing my darts at it. But if the darts feel the gravity of the dartboard, the cross-section only doubles. Okay, so I'm in that regime here in the globular cluster. Now I can take my cross-section and I can work out a time for an encounter to happen. Okay, so I take one particular star, my neutron star, okay, spray it green and follow that star and think how long it takes to have an encounter. Right, so I follow on and it's just basically the encounter timescale is 1 over n sigma v, where n is the number density of things it's going to potentially encounter. Sigma here is the cross-section, not the velocity dispersion. Okay, and v here is the velocities, okay, v infinity. And I plug all that together, put it in nice units, and I've got that here. My encounter time is about 10 to the 11 years, roughly, where the number density of stars is in units of 10 to the 5 stars per cubic parsec, the masses are solar, my r-min is in solar units, and my v infinity is in 10 units of 10 kilometers a second. So in a sort of B plus globular cluster, all of these terms are of order, well, this term and this term are order unity. So you can see that in the core of something like 47 Tuck, the collision time for each star is 10 to 11 years. What that means is one in 10 stars or so has had a physical collision. But it also means that all stars in the core of 47 Tuck are likely to come within 10 solar radii of another star. So that comes back to Brian's comment about that, and I guess Josh as well mentioned it, the idea that all these CVs and things, they're likely to, everything's going to get interfered with in the core of a globular cluster. So encounters happen. I mentioned at the bottom here, they happen between single stars. So in single star case, my Amen is basically either the size of the star, or it'll turn out a few times the size of the star, to raise enough tides to form a bound system. And the Amen in the case of the binary, you can rather imagine, if that's my binary, it's a shame for those watching this on the web, if that's the binary and a single star comes along, something interesting happens when the single star gets within size of the binary within the binary. So it's like that, right? The R min is roughly the size of the binary, in other words. So then that begs the question, how large are the binaries? How big are binaries in globular clusters? Well, the first point to make is that if I have a very wide binary, you might think that's extremely good because it's a nice big target, but if I make a very wide binary, a third star comes along, the kinetic energy of the third star will unbind the binary. Okay, they're called soft, generally, in the literature. Now, if I take stars that are a solar mass, two one-solar mass stars in a binary, for typical globular cluster velocity dispersions, the hard-soft boundary is of order 1,000 solar radii. Okay, that's actually fairly hard for people who do binaries in the fields. Okay, so a lot of binaries, if the binaries in the globulars follow the field distribution, a lot of them are just very wide. They'll get broken up as soon as they see a third star. Speed up, sorry. Okay. I was surprised. Sorry. Okay. So soft binaries are broken up. Hard binaries are hardened. So if I'm a hard binary and I encounter a third star, something complicated happens. I kick the third star and the binary gets harder. So this is an important point. Okay, so one of my three important points here, okay, is because the first half of it, is that even though binaries can be 1,000 solar radii and be hard, they're not going to be 1,000 solar radii today, because they'll have had loads of encounters and they'll have got ground down, and so typical separations of those systems will be between 50 and 100 okay, today. The other point is that if your binary contains less massive stars, that hard-soft boundary, of course, will be smaller as well. Okay. So now what's most important, the binary single or the single-single encounters? How do they compare? So thinking about this equation here. To compare the single-single and binary single event rates, I need to think about two things in this equation. I need to think about how many of these things there are, the things I'm encountering, either the other single stars or the binaries, and how close I have to get to them for something interesting to happen. I've got something here called the 2020 conspiracy. So for single-single star encounters, I have to get within roughly 3 solar radii for something interesting to happen, to form a bound system. Now let's imagine the binaries I'm going to think about are 60 solar radii. Okay, so they're the size of the maximum binaries today, or they're perhaps more typical of the less massive binaries. Okay, so let's just say that as an example, and let's also say that the binary fraction is 5% of the single star fraction. So my 2/20 here is that 60 is 20 times bigger than 3. Okay, and that's 1 over 20, of course. So the binaries are 20 times bigger, but there's 20 times fewer of them. Okay? So that means that the event rate of single-single and binary-single are kind of the same. Now, I'm not saying they're exactly the same. I'm not saying that half of the millisecond pulsars are made in each way. But what we are saying there is you can't necessarily ignore either of them right now. That's an important point. Okay. So my second point concerns encounters with binaries. I'm just going to talk about binary single encounters from now on. Binary single encounters are complicated because a lot of different things can happen. Okay? The simplest thing that can happen is the binary can simply fly by and get a bit harder. The next thing that can happen is this single star can exchange into the binary. That'll happen especially if the single star is much more massive than one of the binary components. Okay? The next thing that can happen that could be very relevant for a lot of systems is during the encounter, two of the stars get close and merge or form a very tight system. So how common are those mergers? We can actually find that out numerically, experimentally, by performing binary single interactions and just seeing how often the stars get close together. And I've done that, and loads of other people have done that too. Pete Hutton, many workers have done that. There's a literature in there. And what do we find? Well, we find that the cross-section to pass within some distance, R min, goes as the cross-section for something to happen in the binary single interaction, times by This Rmin, so say that's 3 solar radii, divided by the size of the binary, to some power law, which is about a half. Okay? What does that mean? It means that if I have an encounter involving a small binary, so Rmin over A is relatively larger, the fraction of encounters that get messy goes up. This is not surprising, right? Okay. But we can quantify it. So to give you an example, if my binary is between 50 and 100 solar radii, and my Rmin is 3, again, the fraction of binary single interesting events that are messy events, where two things pass within 3 solar radii, is around 10 or 30%. Okay. So it's quite a lot. This is quite important when you're starting grinding down those binaries. Even when it's this wide, that's not very tight, right? Not as tight as the systems we want to make, but already 10 or 30% of them are getting messy, right? So you've got a main sequence star, a neutron star, and a white dwarf in some sort of complicated event. The white dwarf slams into the main sequence star, and so I've got a main sequence star engulfing a white dwarf going around a neutron star. And that could then puff up as sort of some kind of funny red giant, go through a common envelope, and all sorts of complicated things. This is utterly unavoidable, right? Because the size of the stars is an undeniable truth. Okay, and that says in very faded blue, interactions with binaries can be messy affairs. Okay. This is actually my last overhead, so we're on time. So that was my second point, okay? That as the binaries get smaller, the importance of the messy events, the mergers, gets larger, and it's an undeniable truth they're going to be important. As an aside for that, I just quickly mentioned that that also means that the binaries themselves are unlikely to get kicked out of the cluster with a binary single encounter, right? Because to get kicked out of a cluster in a binary single encounter, the binary needs to be quite small. If it's quite small, you get a merger quite often, and when you get one of these messy mergers, it sort of stays put in the center of mass frame on average. Okay, so my last point really concerns, it ties in actually in a way with what Eric was saying before, possibly. It ties in with what masses the stars are in the binaries. So what are the binary content, basically? So if you imagine you start off with a population of binaries, just imagine loads of stars of different masses. Imagine you put some stars in the binaries in a random way, or you can try whatever to be nasty. What will happen over time is the massive stars will exchange into the binaries, right? So if I have two stars that are very low mass and a more massive star comes along, one of the less massive stars will get kicked out and the more massive stars in the binary. Okay. This, again, is not complicated. It's very quantifiable, this, because you can do the cross-sections and more massive stars will end up in the binaries. That has very important consequences because if a cluster is just slightly more crowded than another one, all of the primaries in binaries could, say, be one solar mass rather than 0.7 solar mass. Now, you might say, well, that's only 20-30% effect, but then the fraction of systems where one lot have become red giants in the past and maybe gone through a common envelope and make very tight binaries is 100%, and these guys here with all 0.7s, none of them have evolved yet. So the binary makeup and the properties will be incredibly different. So it's a very sensitive function, what we see today, what the average mass is in primaries. Okay, so what's the idea? The idea is the following. It's an idea in this we mentioned already this morning, this paper with Brad in 98, to do with how to make millisecond pulsars. And the idea is the following. I start off with main sequence, stars in a globular cluster. And they're intuitively red here, okay. A green one comes along, so the green one is more massive, right? Okay, so the green main sequence star comes along and it knocks out one of these in a clean exchange. It's a fairly wide binary, this. So it kicks out the less massive of the two. Okay, a neutron star, intuitively blue here, comes along, and because it's more massive than the red star gets kicked out and end up with a moderately massive star and a neutron star. This is quite quantifiable again because all the cross sections are computable, and it turns out one can do this in a globular cluster, and these masses are intermediate. They're more than 0.8, that's the important point, but they're not typically more than 2 or 3. We're not talking about 8 or 10 solar mass stars here. They would clearly knock things out, but they're not around anymore, right? Even a 5 or a 6 solar mass star's life is too short, it doesn't have time to find a partner, okay? You know, if they live longer, they have more time to exchange into a binary. So what we've got then, a few billion years ago, is loads of neutron stars in binaries with 1, 2, 3 solar mass stars. And it could be, for example, that you might retain some this way as well, from Eric's talk. So then the 1, 2, 3 solar mass star evolves, but in the past, gets more massive than the current turnoff. It will fill its Roche lobe, and what happens next is a function of what it is, what the separation is, and all sorts of things. It might go through a common envelope phase, it may not, depending on the period. But nonetheless, it will, whatever it does, even if it's a very luminous X-ray object, it will be doing that all conveniently, but in reality, in the past. And the idea then is that you spin up the neutron star and you see the millisecond pulsars today. So you can actually produce a lot of these IMXBs in globular clusters, and they've all been produced in the past. Okay.
Well, let's hold our applause for later. Actually, the contributions are in decreasing order of length, so we're actually making...
I have actually kept to time.
We're making good progress.
So I really have kept to time.
Right. Saul asked me to make some comments about the population of low-mass hexabionese as we observe and what it might tell you about their formation, if anything. Now, I'm aware that many of you won't know all the ins and outs of hexabionese evolution, and so I just want to make a few general remarks first. If I can get this to work. What I show you here are some evolutionary tracks of 140 binary evolution calculations, and these are tracks in the secondary mass orbital period plane. In all cases, I have a neutron star and a companion star of various masses initially, starting to transfer mass at some orbital period, and then this is the evolutionary track in this plane. Now, the color coding shows you how much time the system spends at different phases. Yellow means it's very fast, and the darker colors mean the evolution is very slow. Now, there are a couple of points to make. First, is that better? First, if you look at the mass range, we go to fairly high initial masses. Now, why is that? Well, the reason for that is that we now believe that in the galactic disk population, many of the systems which are classified as low-mass hexabionese in fact had originally much more massive companions, like 2, 3, or 4 solar masses. Now, when you observe them today, of course they have low masses because the initial evolutionary phase is very fast. Now, we estimate, and these are estimates Eric Fahl has done, that between 80 and 95% of hexabionese in the galactic disk originate from intermediate mass systems. So it's really not, probably not correct to call them low-mass hexabionese. The second thing that you see, of course, which is has been known for a long time, that there is, if you have systems that start with a period longer than about a day, they tend to evolve towards longer periods. While systems that have a period less than about a day evolve towards very short orbital periods. These are Eddington limited calculations. So if the mass transfer rate is super Eddington, it is assumed that all the mass lost in all the mass is lost in excess of the Eddington limit. Who asked that question? No. But I mean, these are details that don't really matter for this big picture here. Right. If you look at it more carefully, systems that are fairly unevolved initially evolve towards periods of around 80 minutes, the classical period minimum. Systems that are close to this bifurcation period, which here is 18 hours, evolve towards very short orbital periods, as short as 5 minutes or so. Now, the bifurcation period itself depends somewhat on the assumptions you make about the binary evolution, including whether it's conservative mass transfer or not, and also things like magnetic braking. Now, the relevant point for globular clusters here is the following. If you look at the observed orbital periods of the high luminosity low-mass hexabionese in globular clusters, of which there are about 13 known, 6 have orbital periods from the shortest system with 11 minutes, 21 minutes, 44 minutes, 4.7 hours, 12.4, and 7.1. All of these periods are below this bifurcation period. And in fact, these evolutionary tracks I showed you can explain all of these periods if the initial period was at 18 hours or less. Now, as Saul already said, we know that X-ray findings are much more common in globular clusters than in the field, and that has something to do with the dynamic interactions. And this is now where it starts to become controversial. There are the two processes that have been discussed already. One is the tidal capture, where you need a star to get very close to a neutron star to rise, to raise enough tides that you can capture a main sequence star into a tight orbit. And the other are three or four body interactions. To make this work, you need a fairly close encounter. Within about, the periastron separation has to be within about 3 stellar radii. Now, if you then ask, what is the orbital period range at which these systems start to transfer mass, you get the following. What I show you here is the contact period, which is the period at which these systems become X-ray binaries, as a function of the relative capture distance at the tidal capture point. And to capture a system, you probably have to be somewhere in the range of 2 and 3. These different curves show you what you expect for different radii of the main sequence star when it's being tidally captured. And what you see, the contact period is just in the right range of 10 to 20 hours, exactly what you need to explain the observed period distribution. Now, this is something you get from tidal capture. If you have a 3 or 4 body interaction, you tend to get much longer orbital periods, tens of days, perhaps a few days sometimes, and I think John will show some of this later. Now, why is this so controversial? Well, it's not clear whether these systems survive the tidal capture. One reason is that the initial interaction is very dynamical, and this is one SPH simulation from Melvin, where he has a fairly close encounter. The initial periastron distance is 1.5 the radius of the star, and you see it is very massive. And this is probably a system that will ultimately merge dynamically. Even if you have a system that survives this dynamical phase, it is not quite clear what happens to all of that energy that's dumped into the star. The orbital energy is always of order the binding energy of the star. And you might expect that the star will swell up and that again it starts to merge. Now, this criticism I think has been a bit exaggerated, because what may also happen is that instead of just swelling and merging, you may just induce mass transfer. And to illustrate that, I've done a calculation here. And I just want to look at this panel, which sort of mimics all the tidal heating you get, where all the orbital energy is deposited in the outer 5% of the star on a very short time scale. And while the star expands and drives mass transfer at a very high rate. But it's not catastrophic as such, provided you can get rid of all of that mass, as you seem to be able to do for intermediate mass X-ray binaries, the system may well survive this initial phase. If it survives that initial phase, then later on, it just becomes a normal low-mass X-ray binary. It has an initial orbit period of 13 hours, and in this particular calculation at the end, it has a minimum period of 30 minutes. So I think this second criticism may not be as severe as people have argued in the past. Now, the final point I want to make is this applies to low-mass stars, but what about intermediate-mass stars, the systems Melvin just mentioned? I think they are generally much more robust against tidal effects. They have a very different envelope structure. They tend to radiate the energy very efficiently, and so it's much more likely that an intermediate mass system can survive this initial tidal capture phase. And that's all I want to say.
Paul, we'll take a break at this point to address some questions, but we'll start with someone other than Fred. No, Fred, you don't have to go to the beach just yet. Just hang on. Okay, Brad.
So you dumped most of the energy in the outer part of the star.
Yeah.
Presumably you should that should also then be rotating much more rapidly than the inner part of the star. How much of a difference does it make if I would have guessed then that you would actually mix that layer hydrodynamically with at least a significant amount of mass below that. How much of a difference does that make if you actually...
Well, I mean, this was really just for illustration purposes. I mean, I've, of course, varied that assumption. And putting it in the outermost layer, as I did, was pretty much the worst case. So if I dump it much deeper, and you might actually expect that you have this mode coupling from the low G modes to high G modes, and then you dissipate the energy of a much, much larger fraction of the star, that would be less dramatic. But I mean, that's certainly, I mean, I would certainly like to know from the people who do these calculations what one should do, and I can calculate that.
We're going to hear more talks later about X-ray binaries and globular clusters in elliptical galaxies. So the one question that comes to mind in some of these scenarios is, if you're involving intermediate mass stars, those systems might well have a different time evolution if you plotted the X-ray luminosity function as a function of age of the cluster. So are there really distinctions one can make between these scenarios that are testable by looking at globular clusters of different ages?
I think the luminosity distribution is quite difficult because when there are intermediate mass systems, the evolution is very fast. So they don't contribute all that much. But I mean, if you have large enough number of systems, you might. But certainly there are chemical signatures. So a system that's now a low mass system that originates from an intermediate mass system will have a very different chemical profile. So that's the way to distinguish, I think.
I don't have it.
No, I know what he's going to say.
Is that why you didn't say? So this is a session on pulsars. Let me just point out the most spectacular failure about this theoretical result. Remember, the radio pulsars, the binary millisecond pulsars, are supposed to be the descendants of these systems. Now, most of the binary pulsars seen in global clusters, or of the type that observers were describing earlier on, they have binary periods around a day and companion masses around 0.2, which puts them right here.
Yes. Of course, there are also the systems down here. I should say that I terminated these calculations near the period minimum. Yes, that's a problem.
So Cygnus X2 is not in a crowded place. I gave a cloakroom in Cambridge and everyone confused. They got confused because I thought I was going to work crowded place. Cygnus X2 is an X-ray binary in the field. But for a complicated reason, which you should read in the literature, we think it's descended from an IMXB. Okay? And I've forgotten the numbers, but Andrew just told me the final period of the system is going to be, what was it again?
10.
A chat show, isn't it? Okay. People who've known X-ray binaries. Okay, Andrew's going to tell us the final period.
It's about 10 hours.
That was 10 hours, in case you missed it, okay.
It is somewhere here.
I mean, I think, in fairness to everyone, I think that the evolution of these systems is an ongoing thing, but I think it's interesting that there's a system in the field, at least, which really the donor mass had to be more massive for reasons I can't spend time on now, but you can read the paper if you don't trust me. I'm sure you all do. Okay, but it really is an descended IMXB. So these intermediate mass donor systems don't all make a horrible, messy, single blobby thing. Some of them survive, and some transfer mass.
But that doesn't really address Fred's point.
Well, my only point then would be that
Cygnus X2 is no problem, and that's in there.
Yeah, no, sorry, let's say, like, sorry, I got that wrong.
It's one of these systems.
Yeah, the final period is not what Sigurd's tooth period is now, but it will be shorter. Okay, that was, sorry, maybe I got confused with people. Okay, they're much shorter period systems. So it's not at all clear. I mean, Fred's point is well taken, but I don't think that we've had the final story with this yet, okay?
You're a chart, so you're...
Okay, a couple of questions. One is in terms of the mass loss, which I agree, and I think this was in the papers that Saul and I did about 10 years ago, that mass loss during the tidal capture process is a way of carrying energy away. In the work that we did, though, we had the mass being carried off really as part of the capture process, because simulations by Fred and others had shown that there was likely to be some mass loss during tidal capture, and that process in itself would likely deal with some of the difficult energy issues. And the simulation,
well, it's more the angular momentum issues, I think.
Hmm?
It's more the angular momentum issues.
And angular momentum issues, right. Now, but as you point, but now in your simulation, you have had mass transfer. Have you also had mass loss prior to that?
No, I didn't put that in. But of course the problem is the mass that's lost from the system, does it carry away more angular momentum than the specific angular momentum of the system or not?
Mm-hmm. Well,
if it carries away angular momentum, then it actually can be quite disastrous.
That's right. But I guess the thing is that we don't have simulations yet that are capable of following the process for long enough to know how that actually works out.
Yes.
But I think it's really the combination of mass loss and mass transfer that would potentially allow some of these systems to survive. And there's also the issue of, you know, how many of them have to survive. You know, as you point out, it's probably not the ones that are below 2 stellar radii, but, you know, maybe between 2 and 3.
Yes.
But actually, in some of the simulations that we did that gave lots and lots of systems, it's between 2.5 and 3, you know? So you don't really need a large part of that space.
Let's have two more questions, one from Josh,
it would be nice if we could solve a couple of problems here at once, right?
Right.
I don't want to take the time because we're short on time, but if I took one of Melvin's view graphs and one of yours, and you allow me, or if we all believe in Ken Nemoto's, you know, AIC scenario, what the basic requirements are, which many of us have pointed out, on M dot and M progenitor, if we take, instead of a massive, instead of a neutron star, we take an oxygen neon magnesium white dwarf, which will be there in larger numbers than neutron stars from primordial evolution, and let that be Melvin's green star, whatever your color was, and put it into your scenario where, with the intermediate mass system, you can produce a phase of high M dot, 10 to the minus 5 or so, I read off your view graph, for of order 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 years, I get my 2/10 of a solar mass at the high M dots that you need, and I make my neutron star and my LMXB simultaneously.
The problem, I think, is that you get a fairly wide orbital period in this. I mean, you were talking about...
No, I think you wind up with... This all works in both of these scenarios.
I think you get a longer period, but... I mean, you really want to get these short period systems, and that's... I don't see...
Well, it's exactly the same kind that you were following.
Oh, you mean that, okay. Oh, I was thinking about something else. Sorry.
It has to work. I mean, the weak point is whether anybody believes you can produce neutrons. But if you can, you can do the whole lot.
Yeah, a whole lot of these systems went from 10 days down to a few hours, which is...
Carol, you guys have gone offline, and the last question is for
you. Okay. So I have a simple question for, I don't know, Brad or Phil or Fred. Why is it that in the disk of the galaxy we find several millisecond pulses with carbon-oxygen white dwarf companions, and in clusters there are 0 that we know of? They're all helium white dwarfs.
Well, the carbon-oxygen white dwarfs, of course, they come from the intermediate mass systems, definitely. Well, in your scenario, they should be there.
It's supposed to be a burst population, which is a globular cluster, and formed these things, 12 giga years ago.
and a population that's continuously forming them. So you could form the carbon-oxygen guys two or three giga-years ago in the disk, but you've had 10 giga-years to destroy them in a globular cluster.
Okay. So what I'd like to do in the few minutes that I have left is talk a little bit about a Monte Carlo globular cluster evolution code that we've been developing. Now, at this conference, there seems to be quite an emphasis on these direct n-body methods, which, you know, they're very nice because they don't use a lot of simplifying assumptions. But to be realistic, you know, to do a reasonable number of stars, they would take almost forever to compute. And the Monte Carlo method, because it's orbit averaged and doesn't actually follow each star's orbit, with it we can do quite a reasonable number of stars in a short amount of computational time. So what's typical is a million stars, you know, which might be a pretty dense cluster. We can do that in about a week on a Pentium 4. And similarly with the binaries, we don't resolve the binary orbits until the point where they undergo strong encounters. So we can do almost any binary fraction with almost no performance hit. And so with 20% binaries and a million stars, it might take maybe, like I said, a week, maybe a little bit more on a Pentium 4. So for the binary and single and binary-binary interactions, we can do, you know, we can handle them in a number of ways. We can either use some of these cross-section recipes, okay, which only work for the equal mass case, or we can actually dynamically integrate a binary-binary or a binary single encounter, which allows us to use a mass spectrum because, you know, the simple recipes just aren't there for those. So that's a nice feature of this code. Another feature of the code, which makes it pretty realistic, is that we have binary and single star evolution. This is based on, well, this is Chris Belchinsky's work, which is based on Hurley et al. And so I should say that I'm working on the binary single and binary binary stuff, and Atakan Gürkan at Northwestern has been working on the binary and single star evolution. At some point in the near future, we'll merge these two things. We'll have a really nice code that can do some nice things. So let me just show a typical simulation. Here we have 300,000 stars initially, 20% primordial binary fraction, and we've evolved it for 600 half-mass relaxation times. And this took about a week on something like a Pentium 4. Jared Hurley tells me that with the Grape 6, this might take 50 years. Okay. So the Monte Carlo code definitely is a nice tool for doing these realistic cluster simulations. And of course, what's more relevant to the talk this afternoon is what happens with the binaries. And we can certainly follow the binaries with time and see how they evolve. And what we have plotted right here is the binary hardness right here versus the position in the cluster. And at time zero, we start with, you know, 1 KT binaries, which are on the hard-soft boundary, all the way up to 133 KT, which, you know, if you have a cluster with a standard velocity dispersion of 10 kilometers per second, this point right here corresponds to contact for a main sequence binary. Okay, and so you can watch this evolve over time, 2 half-mass relaxation times 10. This is probably about where the cluster would be today. But if you had different initial conditions for this cluster, you might actually go down here to about 40 half-mass relaxation times, where in fact you see you do create quite a few really hard systems. Now this is all done with equal mass stars and point mass dynamics. So all these really hard systems that would be in contact probably would have all merged in resonant binary encounters. But if you had, you know, some compact objects in there, you might possibly form these ultra-compact systems. No? Yes?
How hard is hard?
How hard is hard? Oh, I'm sorry. This is 100 kT. This is 1,000 kT, yeah. There aren't very many of these left, you know, because you kick a lot of them out. You know, the numbers here are about 300. No, it's 100 kT for contact of a binary composed of main sequence stars. Yeah, for 10 kilometers per second velocity dispersion. Yeah. And it's about 100 kT, you know, from Hege, where you start kicking them out. But you can keep some of them in there. Oops. All right. So to get a little bit more realistic, you know, without actually using stellar evolution, what I've done is I've started a cluster with a million stars initially, 10% primordial binaries, and a sprinkling of neutron stars that are not initially in the binaries, okay? And the distribution of these objects just follows that of the cluster, so there's no initial mass segregation. What you expect over time is for the binaries to sink into the core at the same time that the neutron stars are sinking into the core. And as the density in the core increases, the binary single interactions will increase, and these neutron stars will exchange into binaries, forming interesting systems. And what I have right here is a... So I've plotted... Now, this isn't actual units. I plotted the hardness of the binaries, which is uniform in logarithm, you know, from something like 10 days up. And it's a thermal distribution, so it's uniform in E squared. So this is the initial distribution. And then 12 billion years later, you can take a look and see what you've got. And, you know, as is well known, these hard binaries right here just get harder anytime they undergo an interaction. And the ones right here at larger orbital periods have larger cross sections, so they're the first ones to do this. So it gets depleted, you know, sort of like this, and you create a few hard systems down here below, you know, a 10-day period. These soft ones right here, so if you have a binary at the hard-soft boundary at 1 kT, it has roughly equal probability of hardening and softening during an encounter, and so that's why you get a few of these soft systems. There's less than you actually see here because of an artifact with, you know, what we were doing in this paper to compare with the previous paper. So you don't actually see that many, but you get a few. So that's nice. Now what's more interesting is to look at the binaries that actually contain neutron stars, because that's what you're interested in, right? And these might possibly be LMXB progenitors. And, you know, for this particular cluster, you get about 3% of the total neutron stars in the cluster into binaries, okay? And, you know, they're all reasonably hard relative to the rest of the population, but not too hard, okay? And, you know, I should say that because we don't have stellar evolution or binary evolution in these models, these are just illustrative at this point. And, you know, pretty soon we'll have all these ingredients put together, and we can do some nice simulations, these kitchen sink type calculations that might actually shed some light on the formation of these systems. I guess that's my main point.
So finally, in a complementary type effort, Natasha is going to tell us a little bit about what she's been doing. And I think that will bring us to the end, and we can have a few questions, and I think we won't be more than 5 minutes behind.
Right, I will talk what one can learn from population synthesis and compare what type of population you have in binaries where one companion is a neutron star. In a normal, compared to the field population, and if you imply some interactions. So if you just try to look on a normal population in a field, here is a result of evolution of 80,000 binaries, binary systems. It's a final periods and final mass of a companion of the binary at the age of 11 giga years. So blue dots represent black holes. Blue dots. Black dots represent when the companion is also neutron star. Two white dots here represent two oxygen neon white dwarfs, and there is only one main sequence star. So not many main sequence stars will be a companion of those neutron stars. You can see that all the binaries relatively wide. I mean relatively wide because they had already chance to shrink due to the mass transfer of common evolution. But they will not have such a chance in the clusters. Also here, we retain all the binaries which will be ejected in the clusters, evaporated in the cluster, are retained. So the picture is dramatically changed once you imply three-body, four-body, and tidal captures interactions. So here, in the cluster, we have only nine systems with neutron stars, only nine binary systems, where six systems are with main sequence stars. One is a white dwarf. This is a carbon-oxygen white dwarf, which actually transferring mass to the neutron star. And black dot is a one double neutron star. You can see that all of them have very, very short period. Also, I should say that all the solid points, they actually represent that your binary is not a primordial binary. All of them formed in exchange. Moreover, at least half of them experienced double exchange. This point, for example, is a binary which was formed through the tidal capture, and currently it's in the mass transfer stage. The system with the white dwarf experienced two mass transfer sequences. So it has a main sequence companion of 0.8 that transferred half of the mass and became a 0.4 main sequence star, and it was lost in exchange interaction to the neutron star. Double neutron star also was formed in a double exchange. So the main point is that whatever binary evolution you look at, normally you will not have this uninterrupted evolution in a global cluster. That's it.
Any final questions for the last few contributions? It's complicated.
I'd like to make a comment sort of echoing Josh's point, which is that it seems to me it would be nice to see all these same calculations done for white dwarfs that should be there, and understanding mass transfer and the origin of CVs and the possibility of AIC. It seems to me that the time has come to sort of broaden this to include the white dwarfs. So I would just really, it seems to me that really needs to be encouraged.
Any others?
People are hungry.
Anytime. All right. Thank you all.